it's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History.
Win.
We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
The Athletic.
What a run of races MotoGP has had over the past 4 weeks. Aragon, Motegi and Buriram made up one of the toughest triple headers in recent times. But it's given us one of the closest MotoGP championships for decades, as Fabio Quartararo has had Pecco Bagnaia close down a staggering 79-point gap since the Sachsenring in the middle of June. Simon Patterson and Valentin Harunci join me, Toby Moody, as we catch up on this MotoGP crescendo with Australia, Malaysia and Valencia still to go, 75 points remaining on the table. Thank you so much to Matt Beer for hosting last week. I did like your Petrucci stand-in stance. Top job, Matt. Simon, you wrote an article on the website about this season now essentially being three races long as this championship comes to a head. Our major contenders are only 2 points apart. Espargaro, he's 20 points back. We'll get round to him in a minute. Now, you said last week that Quartararo is still your favourite for the title. He's my favourite too. Do you still think that a week down the road?
Yeah, I think so. We've seen a bit of a strange week, I think, from Fabio Quartararo in that he's done something strange without doing anything. He's normally the most prolific social media user on the MotoGP grid, and he's taken the bold step this week of deleting his social media presence. He shut down his Instagram page, which to me, on the surface, signals someone that's under quite a bit of pressure. But I think at the same time, knowing Fabio, knowing how he operates, I think what we're actually seeing is someone that's focusing on the job at hand. It feels, knowing him, like this is the removal of a distraction. This is him knowing that it's now or never and kind of single-track mind for the next 3 weeks. Whether or not that's good enough, I don't know. It's obviously going to take more than just logging off Instagram to focus his mind and win a championship after a run of form that means he hasn't won a race since the Sachsenring in mid-June. But I think he remains my favourite for now, but we'll know whether or not that's the case on Sunday evening after this weekend's race at Phillip Island, because I think, quite simply, he has to beat Pecco Bagnaia this weekend. There's no two ways about it. He has to beat Bagnaia this weekend, and if he doesn't, it's championship over.
Now, Val, you said that Bagnaia is still your favourite, but you quite rightly pointed out it's just one of those weird seasons. It's going to continue, isn't it?
Yeah, ultimately, I think if it plays out the normal way, then Fabio could achieve total zen, total nirvana, be completely cool and collected and do every lap the same, and it won't be enough because the Ducatis are too good and they'll just kick him up and down the pit lane. Phillip Island maybe is a close one. Although I think the Ducati will be better at Phillip Island than we even expect, maybe. And I think the Ducati will be too far at Sepang and Valencia in normal conditions. And the problem in the wet is that we saw that. I think the big differentiator is whether Bagnaia will click in the wet, because I think Bagnaia's ceiling in the wet is higher than Fabio's. That's my feeling from what I've seen in the MotoGP so far. Like, both of them could have a total stinker on any given day in the wet. But,
well, we saw that in Thailand, didn't we?
We saw that in Thailand from Fabio. We saw that in Motegi and Indonesia from Bagnaia. But I think even if Bagnaia has like a nightmare, I'm not convinced Fabio will score enough points to really properly capitalize on it. But again, we'll see. It could be absolute bananas nonsense. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think Quartararo will do it, but Yamaha, Ducati, and particularly Aprilia just might have to stop any long-term thinking as they go into a race weekend, therefore be quite reactive as the propensity of difficult weather conditions at the three upcoming circuits, of course, as we know, can be absolutely mad. Teams will have to have every scenario thought out and discussed before each day, each session, and each run, each exit from the garage. Phillip Island, wind, cold, then sun. You get four seasons in 1 hour. Sepang, it can rain out of nowhere, and when it does, it just rains like the Bible, and you need to build an ark. A non-stop race is probably going to happen, or the bigger chance of it happening in Sepang. Who knows what the weather's going to do even tomorrow, let alone in 10 days' time. So they've got to work out when to come in at the right time. They've got to have people positioned around the circuit, radio contact, pit. Like, they've got to think of all the scenarios. Valencia, the final race, cold tarmac, and pressure, mental pressure. Simon, you've touched on it. Mental pressure upon all of them, like the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. It's going to be immense. Now, Aleix Espargaró is only 20 points back. If you look at the closest Formula One title showdown for some years, we need to look back to 2007. With three races to go, it was Kimi Raikkonen way back in third from Lewis Hamilton and Fernando Alonso. From a possible 30 points available, Kimi took 26 points in the last three Grand Prix. A third, a win, and a win. Now, if Aleix Espargaró does that, he'll take 66 points.
Yeah.
But I keep coming back to what you say, Val. It's just one of those seasons. And what I said in the middle of the summer, it's just going to be one of those years. It might all be pie in the sky stuff, but it happened in MotoGP as well back in 2006 with Valentino Rossi and Nicky Hayden and the crescendo when we came to Valencia. Anything can happen. And I think it's just going to be one of those. Flip a coin.
If there's a team and a rider who's best positioned to kind of be reactive and take advantage of the chaos, I think it probably is Aprilia and Espargaró. I think they're the ones who have less to lose, who can take more risks. Hell, 12 months ago, who expected them to be title contenders? No one. So exactly. That puts them in a better position, I think. And then you combine that with the fact that we went to Sepang testing earlier this year and the Aprilias blitzed the rest of the field. I don't think that Aleix is a title contender in the same breath as Bagnaia and Quartararo, but I think that he still has a real good dark horse chance.
I don't really see Aleix winning the. If two out of three is what it takes, Kimi Raikkonen, I don't see that happening particularly. If anything, from where I'm standing, there's a better chance of all three races being wet and Jack Miller entering the title race by just being good in all of them while everyone else is no good. But that's also just, a lot of things really have to align. But, you know, our priors are going to change immediately on Friday this weekend, then on Saturday, then on Sunday. It's going to be 15 other opportunities to evaluate our stance on who's the favorite. It's fun. It's really fun. And it's such a weird thought that just came to my mind is, I'm saying it's fun, so why am I not enjoying it this much? And obviously we're about to talk about the quality of racing, but it's not that for me. I'm tired. It's been a lot of races and I'm tired and I feel fatigued by this title race. And the same thing happened with F1 last year, but F1 was of course just very acrimonious and unpleasant and endlessly way too long and controversial. And this isn't that, but I'm still tired. But that might just be a personal thing.
Well, let's hope it's not controversial like Abu Dhabi, because I don't think we need that. In fact, we don't. But likewise, we don't need somebody else being knocked off and stewards and race direction and all that kind of stuff.
Definitely not.
We don't need that. I can see what you mean about being tired. You know, it's a long season. Simon's been traveling the world. It's even harder for Simon. But I'm loving it. I think it's great. I think it's just nuts. And I wouldn't want to be a factory Ducati person or a factory Yamaha person. I think the lack of sleep and the blood pressure would just be too much.
So to lead quite nicely into what we're going to talk about next, actually, I agree with Val in that I'm not really enjoying it either, I think. And the reason for that is that this year's title race feels like this year's races. They've been super close, but they've not been, you know, it's almost like the lack of competition and the lack of overtaking in the races has been transposed in the title race as well, because we've had this like title race of two halves where Quartararo had a really strong start to the season and built up a big points lead, and then Bagnaia has just won everything since. It's almost like, you know, if you're to compare the season to a race, it's not somewhere where they're passing each other every lap. It's somewhere where someone is overtaken at the halfway point and is just clearing off into the distance. I haven't enjoyed this championship race at all, which is weird.
Maybe it's the lack of fairing-to-fairing Quartararo and Bagnaia, like a Lorenzo and a Rossi and a...
I think it's the lack of fairing-to-fairing anyone.
Well, there is that, yeah.
No, that's...
Yeah. Might have hit the nail on the head there, unfortunately. But, if you're Aprilia, you want to be a bit more risk-taking than go by the book. And... that wing it factor might just do it, because to bridge that 20-point gap for Espargaro at the moment might seem too much, but if you just throw a dice and you just get a double six, then poof, all of a sudden you're in the game.
I mean, three races ago, who would have said that the Quartararo would have non-scored in two of the next three?
Yeah, 8 points out of three races.
And here we are. So... the next three races will be even more manic.
I cannot remember a fight back like Bagnaia. Well, I mean, the stats say it themselves. No Ducati rider has won four on the trot.
Yeah, no, it's mathematically unprecedented. I think the Lorenzo Rossi thing of 15 was two times fewer the points or something like that. So it really is absolutely unprecedented, and it basically took the Quartararo Yamaha package cratering, being stuck in the pack, falling off, struggling in the wet. That's what it took.
And you know, to contextualize how bad the start of the season was for Bagnaia, I think it'll also match the record. If he wins the title, it'll match the record for most DNFs in a title year.
And yet win the title.
And still win it. Yeah. That's how bad his start to the season was. You know, that's this weird championship of two halves again that we've had. It's been...
And honestly, he could get another one and still somehow win it. So,
yeah, absolutely. And still win the title. Absolutely, yeah.
That's just nuts, isn't it?
What's the record?
Yeah.
Or are we going to have to edit that in?
Because he's matched it.
By whom?
Oh, there's like... there's three or four guys have done it.
Okay.
Yeah, but no one's had five crashes in a season and won it.
Okay.
So there's something to aim for, Paco.
And he's had five. And by the way, Bastianini, 39 points back, technically could do it, but
yeah.
Yes, pigs quite haven't taken off yet, but they are in departure zone. Okay, well, there's a scenario for these last three Grand Prix, isn't there? My goodness me, what a run it's going to be for those last 75 points.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
As we look forward to the finale to this 2022 MotoGP season, we're going to maybe look back on how the racing has been in MotoGP this year. Has it been any good? There's been all sorts of chitter-chatter on social media and people not maybe happy with the follow-the-leader nature of the races and the lack of fairing, banging and wham bam thank you ma'am into the last corner. Lots of people blaming the aero, lots of people blaming the technical devices, many few convinced that World Superbike is a much superior product right now. You've touched on it already, guys, so far in this chit chatter. Simon, is the aero the friend of the engineers and the enemy of the fans?
Yeah, I think, yeah, plain and simple, it is. And I think we kind of understand why as well. So first of all, just to caveat what I'm about to say, I think it's hard to argue that the racing this year is as good as it ever has been in MotoGP. We're not watching 2019 or 2018, where we had a championship that was dominated by Marc Marquez, but it wasn't easy for him. Even if he made it look quite easy, he was, maybe the best way to describe it is he was almost like, he was at that level of comfort where he was able to do what Valentino Rossi was able to do at his Repsol Honda pump and battle for the fun of battling. You know, we saw these awesome last lap duels with Andrea Dovizioso, with Fabio Quartararo, with a few others that made great racing, where they were overtaking each other multiple times, where they were stuffing it up the inside of each other, banging fairings in the way past. That's been completely absent this year. I think the only couple of occasions we've had for that this year for a win has been effectively neutered by Ducati's quasi-team orders. So, you know, as a result, we have lost something. The reason for it is the aero, in a way. The specific cause for it, I think, from speaking to people in the paddock and people who know better than me, we have a situation where, for maybe the first time in history, bike development has made a huge jump forward in a very short period of time and has left behind tire technology. Normally, the tire technology is like the controlling factor. You build the bike to suit the tire. You don't do the opposite. But with COVID, with this two-year hiatus, some development, and with Ducati in particular pumping so much money into aero and ride height devices all at one time, what it's meant is that we've left behind the tire technology. We're now in a position where MotoGP bikes are overloading the front tire pretty much all the time, especially if you're behind another bike in a pack. An overheating, overpressured front tire means less sensitivity for the rider, and less sensitivity for the rider means less confidence in making hard-braking overtakes and getting past people. The long-term diagnosis of all of this as well isn't particularly promising, because it is something that will be fixed. It's something that we know how to fix. But right now we can't fix it because we have so little testing and so much racing in a longer than ever 21 race calendar with sprint races every weekend that Michelin simply can't find the track time to develop a new tire. They had originally speculated that it was going to be 2024 before they were able to bring a new front tire that they were comfortable with. I have heard some whispers this week that it's now 2025. Which potentially means another 2 years of what we've got right now.
I should say, I said I was slightly fatigued of the season of the title battle, but that shouldn't, for me, that's not really hand in hand with the quality of racing, because my observation is that it's been fine. Like, well, I don't think that on average, if you take the average race from this season, I don't think you'd call it bad necessarily. Like, there's no absolute catastrophe that was going on, again, in F1 when they've introduced the higher downforce cars for 17, 18. That was unwatchable. This is watchable. It's not World Superbikes, but that, you know, that happens sometimes. I think back to 10 years ago when I was just getting into all of this stuff. And I remember holding and being really proud of the hipster position that World Superbikes is better than MotoGP, because it was at that point. But the prestige wasn't there, and rightly so, because of the respect, the relative budgets, the relative quality of the grids. But the races were better to watch, and you could still very much make the argument that they are right now in World Superbikes. Although I would also argue that maybe World Superbikes is a touch more predictable in terms of, like, I've just opened this. We've had 12 people lead laps this season, 8 people lead double digit laps. That's pretty good. I think a lot of motorsport championships would kill for that. 8 people double-digit laps. That's excellent. So, you know, again, I like the results variance, for instance, quite a lot. And it's not like there's been a total moratorium on overtaking. It clearly doesn't come as easy anymore. And clearly there's a problem in terms of following and in terms of people finding the opportunities. But there's there's still passing. And people say there's no passing at all. I think that's, you know, we're getting away with ourselves a little bit. So yeah, again, this is not like an impassioned defense of Arrow whatsoever. If I were to launch an impassioned defense of Arrow, I'd say that I think there's maybe a belief that I can't really accurately assess that it makes riding safer and makes it less likely for riders to get chucked off their bikes into space, which I like. I do not want to see really bad crashes and really bad crashes in the pack. And if we have this for fewer crashes, I'm on board with it, reasonably so. But that's, you know, that's one for people with a degree. But yeah, no, that would be my defense of Arrow. My argument against Arrow would be that, yeah, the racing clearly could be better. And my other argument against Arrow would be that it's ugly. It's really ugly. I don't have the F1 type of thing where people see some garbage winglet on the barge board and go like, wow, amazing innovation. Look at this piece of trash they've stuck on, this plastic abomination. I think as a MotoGP public, there's a, you know, you see some nonsense stuck on the rear seat unit and you go like, ew. And that's the correct way to look at it.
I saw a photograph the other day of I think the 2011 Yamaha of Lorenzo, and man, I just forgotten how beautiful a clean looking motorbike without aero is. It's just a gorgeous thing.
Yeah.
But it also kind of highlighted the problem that the Japanese factories in particular are having with aero, because it also kind of looked like a Yamaha 500 Grand Prix bike in that it hadn't really changed that much in the course of 15 years leading up to there. But you know, it's hard to look at the seat unit of the current Ducati with its stick-out Stegosaurus fins and think, yeah, that's cool. Like, it's just... It has none of the... At least the sort of the inherent beauty that I think a Formula One wing has. There's just nothing to it. It just looks hard. Yeah. It looks like something made by a primary school kid in art class to take home to a parent that wasn't particularly happy to get it, you know?
You know, as you say, I think I'm also of the opinion that a top line machine should have a sort of streamlined quality to its, like, everything should be like combined and flowing. There should be no sharp 90 degree thing sticking out. That said, you know, I brought up the Stegosaurus thing because it's just, you know, at the top of my head. But actually, I think that's on the ugliness scale, that's relatively fine compared to the absolute horror that goes on at the front of the bikes. All those cascading bits of whatever nonsense that, you know, fly off sometimes and litter the track. It's not a very analytical or scientific way to look at things. Just basically go, ew, I don't like this. This is not nice to look at. But at the same time, you know, we look back at the F1 cars of 2012 and 2014 with their disgusting cascading noses or sticking out things, like absolutely phenomenally gross. And I wonder if one day in MotoGP we'll also look back at these things and go like, oh, what's going on there? How many people will look back fondly at this?
No one.
Sort of, yeah, Christmas tree stuff on the front.
Yeah.
But it's going to take somebody with knowledge of aero and such like to say stop. And they're going to have to give enough notice for them to make a package without aero and such like. In the defense of aero, the people who would say that, not necessarily me, are the engineers. It is a prototype championship. You are there to make the thing go quickly. And at the moment, Ducati won this year's Constructors' Championship. They achieved what they were employed to do. You have to take ourselves, 180 degrees to the other side of the fence and be in the engineer's shoes. You've been in a team, Simon. I've been in a team. I'm currently in a team in another form of motorsport. You don't care how you do it. You want to win the bloody race. And if it means sticking on a Stegosaurus because it, in the tunnel, and we'll never know those figures, of course, in the tunnel, it shows that it gives you X on a corner, X on deceleration, X, whatever it may be over a lap, and it gives you a tenth of a second, bolt it on. Just bolt it on, because there's a hole in the rules that enables you to put some aero on that particular place. You know, NASCAR have it, Formula One have it, to a certain degree MotoGP have it. You can't put aero here, here, and here. But of course, ironically, the box is still quite open where the aero around the front of the bike, the leading edge of the fairing, just on the side of the radiator intake and such like, is quite open for for that aero to be stuck out. In a long chat with Tom O'Kane at Suzuki, soon to be Yamaha next year, he says the braking distances have collapsed in the last couple of years. They are so much shorter. And that is partly to aero, partly to braking technology with the discs, with the calipers, with the pads, with the carbon discs, with the size of them and such like. And that, of course, likewise puts more pressure on the Michelin front. It heats it up. It agitates the tire walls. It gets it excited. It heats it. And then all of a sudden, they're pinging like a pea on a drum. And that is one of the things that Quartararo couldn't get on with a wet tire, admittedly, at Buriram. So, you've got to look at it from an engineer's point of view as well, which is, well, I'm there to make the bike go fast. Don't care what it bloody looks like. And that's the dilemma between us, the artists, and them, the engineers.
and therein fundamentally lies the problem with MotoGP right now, in that we have a rule book that's written by the engineers. And much like riders are not the only advocates for safety, engineers should not be the only advocates for what goes into the engineering of a MotoGP bike, because at the end of the day, the purpose of MotoGP as a whole isn't to go as fast as possible, it's to deliver good entertainment. But we've got this system where the rules can only be amended by a unanimous vote of the Motorcycle Sports Manufacturers Association. It can't be changed until the end of 2026, when the current agreements between the teams and the factories and Dorna run out. I would be very, very surprised if there's not some very, very substantial modifications made to the rule book at the end of 2026. Not that change, you know, we're not talking hybrid technology or batteries. We're not even talking 990s as opposed to 1000cc engines. We are specifically talking aerodynamics at that point. I think we will see a big rewriting of the rule book at that point.
I think potentially the ideal way to go about it in light of all that would be some sort of working group of specialists that aren't really attached for anybody trying to come up with a way. I mean, the way I would go would be spec aero of sorts, spec aero that's, you know, aimed at both producing stability and yet also minimizing the wake and, you know, the problems. But also you would, for that to have any meaning, you would have to get, I think, a priori sign up from all the manufacturers that, like, whatever the group finds and whatever it says we should do, that's what we're doing. And that's, I guess that's fantasy land for Dan, but that's how I would like to see it. And yeah, you know, if aero helps riders be safer, if that's their general feeling, and it's sort of been hard to tell depending on who rides for whom, but I think they're a lot more on board with the aero than the devices, a lot more on board. And if the aero helps them be safer, then, you know, come up with some spec aero that minimizes the wake impact. I'd be okay with that.
You know, purpose of exercise, make bike go round in circle as fast as possible. So if it is a squat suspension, a launch device, aero, then that's what they've got to do. Thing about wings is, it's a no jokes, please. It's a cascading thing from cars, isn't it? They were put onto Formula One cars, they were put onto to rally cars, touring cars, and then you could buy them to drive on the road with a wing on it. Oh, that's cool. Oh, it must go fast because it's got a wing on it. And then it's cascaded down into bikes, and you can go out and buy a Panigale Ducati V4 and it's got wings on it. And it is a hell of a thing to look at. It is a complete device. And then they take a Panigale V4 Super Duper and they take it to Jerez and they put a pro rider on it with road legal tires, my lud. Technically, they might be very expensive, but road legal tyres, and it goes, help me out, Simon, doesn't it go like 3 seconds off the back of a Grand Prix tyre?
Yeah.
You cannot do that with a car. You cannot get within 3 seconds of Lewis Hamilton, a Max Verstappen, a George Russell, whoever. Not even the WEC LMP1 Le Mans cars could get within 3 seconds of a Formula One car around Silverstone or Spa.
Are you challenging me?
Well, unless it was a 919 Porsche Evo, but that was a out of regulatory car. Hell of a thing, though.
Yeah.
It is a cascading thing down, and somebody somewhere has got to try and restrict it, just as Formula One did. They had a working group. You touched on it. They had a working group. They came up with these different wings for 2022, different car, Pat Simmons and such like. They headed a working group, and it seems to have worked. It seems to have worked in Formula One, yeah, but that's not the work of a moment. And as you touched on, Simon, with the rule book being essentially written by engineers, you've got to get them to come over to the show side of things, and that's not going to be an easy thing. But Formula One managed to do it. So if they can do it, we can do it.
So bear with me, because I've fleshed this out while we've been talking. There was no prior planning went into this mad theory that I'm about to deliver to you. But there is one solution to this problem that Dorna could, in theory, work right away to implement for the near future. They're struggling to find enough track time to test the new 2023 tyre, right? The new 2024 tyre that's now potentially being pushed to 2025, because there's like 12 days of testing between now and the start of the 2025 season. That's how compressed we've got.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an easy solution. You go to Suzuki, who are leaving this championship despite having a deal. You say to them, we'll take your bikes and all of the spare parts you've got for them. You hire like the six people it would take to run a bike for a season. You stick someone like Sylvain Gintoli on it. You say you can't score championship points. The bike will be in Michelin colours, and you use it for the rest of, for the entire of next season to test that front tire. You put someone on track every weekend just to develop a tire, because it has to come sooner rather than later.
Good idea. Good idea. Could be a runner. Suzuki could earn money out of it, because they might run out of spare parts as well. But so yeah, that does work.
Yeah.
Bridgestone did it with Jürgen van der Gerberg. Bridgestone did it with Shinichi Ito. Before they came into MotoGP 20 years ago now, of Kanemoto ran the bike. They help me out, Val. Formula One, before they went over to the new smaller profile Pirelli tyre, they had tyre tests with the teams on a Monday after a race, and they kind of gave everybody a chance to have a go with them.
Yeah, no, that happened. There were team-specific tyre tests. There was also a Pirelli Mule car based off a Lotus from a previous season or previous two seasons ran by Heimel Gersuari, I believe. It didn't run in races, but it just did a testing program, which honestly, what Simon's proposing, because you want to study the wake example in specific, so you'd like him to run in races, maybe just European only then, to
exactly
minimize the spend. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, is this a simpler idea? Not that any of us have got the magic bullet, but why not just have more days of testing, but you can only test the new tyres?
Because teams won't do it. Because teams will not do it. They'll say, oh, yeah,
well, they're their own worst enemy then.
Yeah, of course they are. But it goes back to the fundamental issue we had at the start, Toby, about the engineers want to go faster.
Well, if they don't go testing with the new tyre and they sit in the hotel and they have a nice long lunch, then they're going to miss out on the development direction of the new tyre.
They'll be on track. No, they'll be on track with the new tyre, but they won't be testing the new tyre. They'll be testing electronic strategies. There'll be new swing arms. It won't be used for tyre testing. And I know that because when Michelin bring a new tyre to a test right now, no one tries it.
Well,
and then they all complain about it when it arrives. Of course they are.
I'm sorry.
Of course they
are. I don't like to be outspoken, but they're stupid. If you've got the opportunity to change the technical direction of a control product, and if you say that they don't put their heart and soul in it, then I'm flabbergasted to learn that.
That's what we see. That's what we see. Michelin tell us we're bringing a new tyre to a Monday test. We speak to riders afterwards. How was the new tyre? We only used it for one exit, or we used it, but we were doing some electronic strategy work at the time, or, we ran out of time. It happened at Misano.
F1 dealt with that by giving control over the track program to the tyre manufacturer. That's how that works. You show up and then Pirelli runs your car the way it wants. Well, like you run your car, but Pirelli tells you what to do with it.
Yeah.
Pirelli tells you what settings to mess about with. And then you learn as much as you can in the constraints of that, but you do the running. Pirelli tells you, you do not test new parts. You do not,
So then the other option, if we don't go with the Suzuki thing, is every manufacturer is told they have to do a wild card a certain number of wildcards, and the crew chief at those wildcards works for Pirelli or for Michelin.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't mind that.
You know? Every rider has a factory test rider.
Yeah.
You know, there is ways that this could be sped up. And to be fair, that would be a slightly better process, because then you're testing out in every bike. You know, 10 European races, 10 European wildcards, every manufacturer has to do two. There's another solution.
It might be 15 years ago, but Michelin could make a MotoGP race tyre overnight.
Yeah.
And what you've touched on today, Simon, is that they might not be able to make a new tyre until 2020. I've run out of fingers.
Five. Two seasons.
If our listeners could see my face. I keep saying it to people in my other walks of my life. We all come from a prototype world. When something's broken, you just fix it. Let's see how that one shakes out. But 2025, that seems a long time ago. Away. Seems a very long time away. We've had some voice questions from you guys listening from all over the world. We've got five of them to run here right now. The first of which is Ryan from London.
G'day, folks. Ryan here. An Aussie in London. I have been a fan of the show for a couple of years. I've been a MotoGP fan for probably 20 years and a rider for about 15 years. And I've had all sorts of bikes, from sports bikes to more street oriented, nowadays a super naked, and also a VFR 400 race bike I had for a couple of years and did some track days on at Eastern Creek and the glorious Phillip Island. What a place. And my question to you is, do you ride? And it occurred to me when it was asked on another podcast, and the answer was no. And I thought, that's quite interesting, because as a rider, when watching the MotoGP races at work, whether it's free practice, qualifying, or even in the race, you can get a lot out of it. You can really relate to what they are doing when you see the tyres squirming in certain ways, the suspension working in certain ways, how they're positioning their bodies differently, especially between different sessions, the different body language. And of course, I'd never be able to replicate anything that they do, but I can, to some extent, understand it and relate to it a little bit. And so, yeah, that's the main question, really. Do you ride? And if not, how are you looking at all those tiny little details? And if I have a second question or request even to you guys, let's give the Moto3 and Moto2 a bit more airtime. I watch them every weekend, the races at least. And, you know, it's the grassroots of the sport, and I think they deserve a bit more airtime. Thanks, I love the show. Keep it up. Cheers.
Thank you, Ryan. As you say, from London, but not quite from London, we jest. I did ride a lot. I got my job in the Grand Prix motorcycle paddock. I was 23 years old. I didn't have a bike license, but I made sure that I did have a bike license quite quickly so that I could do exactly what you're talking about, which is at least try and understand at a slower speed, admittedly, of what the guys I was watching every couple of weeks were going through. I had some quick bikes. I did all sorts of silly things on the road, did lots of track days. Now that's when you really learn about what to do. I had some tuition. Neil Hodgson gave me some great tuition at Silverstone. I was on a 1098 Ducati or something or other. And of course, he's doing his gloves up on the way into COPS, and I'm vaguely, oh dear, you know, it's just an example of how there is so much difference between a pro and an amateur. I'd be the middle group on a track day. Great fun. I've been on the Ducati two-seater. I've been on the Yamaha 500cc two-stroke two-seater. Been on the back of Cal on an R1 around Silverstone. I think you have, Simon, as well. That's an experience. I've competed in cars, hill climbs. I've been successful on an amateur level, held some class records. So I've got a little bit of an idea, but I don't ride on the road anymore. I've got a family. I've had a few close shaves. And as Gerhard Berger used to say, every time you have a crash, you write a check. One day there is no more money in the bank. Well, I don't even want to write my first check.
So I didn't ride again until I started working in motorbike racing. Although for me, it was when I was at British Superbikes with Motorcycle News. But again, quickly learned after that, quickly got my license. My license is, my riding, I find, is largely irrelevant to my job, in that I will never be fast enough to fully comprehend, to be able to fully translate what I see on track to what I see and through the visor when I'm on a bike. But I'm lucky that I'm surrounded by some super, super, super smart people who are very, very good at explaining what we are seeing, and I generally get them to translate for me at a much slower pace, and find that that helps more than anything. One of the single most important things I've ever done professionally. I walked a lap of the service road at Jerez one day during a World Superbike test with Bradley Smith, and it was just the most enlightening thing, because you're watching guys come past lap after lap after lap, and he's telling you every lap what they're doing. So things like that are far more helpful for me than road riding. In terms of actually getting on a bike, my lifestyle of being in MotoGP doesn't leave an awful lot of time for it, because the only time that I'm ever in the same place for any extended length of time is in Ireland in November, December and January, which is not when you want to be on a motorbike. So what I tend to do is to get in sort of short, sharp bursts of motorbike riding, like last year, whenever we had 3 weeks, sort of a week and a half each side of Circuit of the Americas. I flew to LA, I borrowed a Harley, I rode 7,500 kilometers across America, and that was my bike fix for the year, until the next time, because... Yeah, like I say, you just don't want to be on a motorbike in Ireland in December, do you?
Not really, no.
I'm from a place without much of a bike culture to speak of. So my entire extent of being on a motorcycle, my entire experience is being in the Thailand MotoGP race and finding out that much of the local taxis is in fact bikes, and just getting rides from them, which honestly ruled. Absolutely phenomenal stuff. But yeah, no, you are right, and it's something that definitely honestly crosses my mind on basically a every weekend basis. And it's obviously, even if I were a regular road rider, I would not feel anywhere near the same sensations they do. But it is a certain limitation and uncertainty in your head that you can't replicate what they feel. You can't fully understand the mechanics of what they do, and sometimes it's a part that you sort of check in your head. That, you know, you're like, you have to know that you're not fully sure. You have to be like, this is my understanding of it, but I have to know that, you know, there's a potential blind spot there. Which is also why you basically mostly see me as a numbers data guy, looking into pace, again, it's just a weird personal quirk. I watch bikes on track and I watch bikes on the TV screens, but honestly, I like the timing page more. I seem to feel it gives me more of an idea on what's happening.
One thing I do have to add, just to give myself back a little bit of credibility, is that I've never raced a motorbike or really rode much on track, but I have managed to have a racing crash after doing 5 laps of Mallory Park on the back of sidecar world champion Tim Reeves' sidecar outfit, and getting arm pumped so severely that my arm stopped working as he jettisoned me off the side of the sidecar through a 90 mile an hour corner. So I've been through a gravel trap on a race circuit, which has to count for something, right?
Just coming back to your question, Ryan, you know, it's not all about what is on the racetrack with the actual riding skill of the riders. It's about the analysis, and it's that mental approach of each rider. Have they put their Instagram account on pause for a couple of weeks? What are they like when they take their helmet off in the garage when the doors are closed? How do they approach the racing? Do they go out on a Sunday night and have a blowout with a load of beers and friends, or do they have a cup of coffee and a tea and they tuck themselves up in bed? That's what the journalists analyze quite well. And also, you know, when you've been in the game a bit, you can refer back and go, that happened in 2001 and it didn't work, or that happened in 2000 but it did work. So that's maybe the strength of what the journalists try, at least, to do.
The other thing is, I think that as a collective body, the journalists cover all approaches. I think, you know, I cover personalities. I think you do to a certain extent, Toby. You've also got a lot of history. Val does data and numbers. We have Neil Spaulding come on occasionally to discuss tech. You have people, especially on TV, like Simon Crafer or Michael Laverty, who understand riding and racing. So as a collective whole, I think that, you know, no one person is going to do all. So I think as a combined effort, we get there. And just to touch very briefly on your other point about covering Moto2 and Moto3, I watch every second of them as well. Trust me, it's not just you. And I really wish we could have, I really wish we could give them a bit more time. But as we creep up to like the 48 minute mark on this week's podcast, on a weekly podcast, I just don't have hours in the day to do another podcast on Moto2 and Moto3 as well. That's the sad reality of it.
And it, honestly, it's not something you can sneak by the editors. They're going to look at us and go like, you spoke for 2 hours about Moto2 and Moto3. Who is this for? Like, yeah, there's going to be some people who are into it, but not enough for us to, you know, spend our time editing it altogether. So, you know, it's supply demand, but we pay attention and we'll, trust me, you'll see in the off-season definitely discussions. And,
yeah, and there's always Moto2 and Moto3 stories popping up on the site. Yeah. From certain angles.
There you go. Next up.
Hey guys, this is Dean.
And this is Rachel.
First time, long time.
We're calling from Harlem in New York City.
And our question for you, since my guy Maverick is on a precipice of making history, we're wondering, are there other bikes on the grid that you think he could win on?
And are there other riders out there who could pull off something similar?
Thanks, guys. Take it easy.
Hi, Dean and Rachel. That question must have been, there must be a screenplay for it. Like, line here, Dean, line here, Rachel, together.
There's more organization has went into asking that question than there's going to go into answering it.
Yeah, no, it would be coherent. We can't have that. I think we're fairly confident he can win on the Aprilia. And Ducati, I think, is a no-brainer. He definitely went on that. If they put him on that, the current Honda and KTM, I have some questions over. Honda, just the current level is not so good. KTM, he maybe wouldn't get the time. But yeah, no, you know, Maverick is like the underlying talent there is not in question. You get him on his day of days on any bike. I mean, he's super. So yeah, I think Ducati is a clear answer for you there. Is there anybody else on the grid who can do that? Mark would win on any piece of garbage you put him on.
I think he'd probably win in a Moto2 bike.
Yeah, he's absolutely Mark on any of them. on rain tires on a dry track. The others, I mean, Mark is such an obvious answer that I'm really struggling for any other name, because it's a question where you're like, it, Mark, yeah.
I think if the bike improves a little bit, the next person to switch manufacturer and win a race in a second manufacturer will be Juan Mir.
You'd hope so.
I think the Honda plays very, very well to his style. And out of sort of the guys moving next year, that's probably the most likely contender for me. Can't say more about Maverick. You're absolutely right. I don't think he'll ever win a title in any bike, because it is all about him on his day. But he could absolutely win, you know, on multiple machines, races.
Hi, guys. Paul from Buckinghamshire in the UK here. Question for you. At the Japanese GP in Motegi, when Aleix had those issues with his bike and he came in and switched onto his spare, I noticed, and it's something Toby mentioned on Twitter as well, that the spare bike didn't have the sweatband over the brake master cylinder. And it's something I've always wondered, what's the purpose of that sweatband? Is it advertising space, or does it serve a useful purpose? Thanks.
Paul, it does absolutely serve a useful purpose if the screw cap on top of the reservoir vibrates itself loose. Now, the thread on that screw cap is quite fine, and they can tighten it up as much as they can, but ultimately it is two different pieces of plastic screwed together. The violence, the vibration, the stuff that's going on, the energy that's going on a MotoGP bike is immense. And if it does unscrew itself, then the brake fluid, will start to leak out. That's evil stuff. That's evil stuff. And it gets in the way and it attacks stuff and everything. So it's just a bit of a fail safe. If the screw top starts to come undone, then the fluid will be captured by the sweatband. Now, the sweatband of all sweatbands, of all golden hierarchical sweatbands, are HRC. Because they've got a little HRC logo embroidered into them. Not just a blue one, not just an orange one, not just with Repsol card. HRC. And they have been the holy grail of stuff to get from a friendly HRC mechanic since Jesus was a carpenter. It is the thing to get. Johnny Eyre, who used to work at HRC and now works at KTM, good friend of this podcast, he said, if I had a friend come and ask me to get one of those little HRC sweatband things, if I had a quid for every person who asked me, I'd be a millionaire and I wouldn't need to go to work. But they're cool things, aren't they? But I think what happened in Motegi was that there was a bit of a thrash to get the bike ready for what was probably not going to be a stop-go race, you know, a flag-to-flag race. So arguably, did they kind of half-heartedly, I'm going to whisper this, half-heartedly get the bike ready? Because it wasn't technically ready and then the fluid could have leaked out and played merry hell with the spare part, with the parts underneath.
I think what probably happened there was, I think they changed clutches for wet and dry. And it's possible that they were in the process of changing the bike from a dry setup as a spare bike for the grid to a wet bike in case it was a flag-to-flag. And maybe they were like halfway through that swap process, which would have involved topping up clutch fluid. And it was just, you know, it's in the list of things that you have to do to switch a bike from a dry setting to a wet setting. That's like second from bottom. It's way down the list. Funny story, a few years ago, I don't know if you remember, a Marshall nicked a sweatband from someone's bike while they were holding it in a slowing down lap.
Yeah.
And it was caught on the bike's onboard camera. Well, quite funnily, after that, Brembo turned up in the media centre and went to like the 10 journalists that go to most races and gave us one each as a little reminder of the Marshall that stole one. So I have a Brembo one at home somewhere.
They're cool little things. Full factory, aren't they? Full factory.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we go from Buckinghamshire in the UK to Essex.
Hi, guys. This is Jack from Essex in England. Love the content you make, and thank you for that. I have two quick questions I'd love to hear you discuss. First being Alex Marquez to Crosini Ducati next year. Is this the beginning of Ducati's courtship of Marc Marquez? And secondly, the controversial sprint format next year. Do you think this would favour some riders more than others? I personally think that Miller will flourish in this environment and potentially could very much mix the championship up for this reason. Thank you very much. Bye.
Hi, Jack. So, yeah, I think regarding Alex Marquez, I think it might be the first step towards trying to court Mark. Yeah, but it's not going to be the deciding factor. But it's what is absolutely clear is that Alex and Mark, who are very, very clearly very, very close, they live together, they train together, they chat all the time. What is clear is that they will be discussing the situation at home, and Mark will be getting input from Alex. And when this was put to Mark, I think a few months ago, when the Alex move was first announced and Mark returned to the paddock, he said that, you know, obviously we have a very tight relationship. We talk to each other, but we're going to have secrets from each other. I'm not going to be telling him about some Honda plans. He's not going to be telling me about some Ducati plans. And I think what he's trying to say there is there's not going to be industrial espionage in that. Obviously, there's not going to be previews of the upgrades. I think that much is clear. I don't think anybody benefits anything from any of that. But as to whether Marc Marquez will get a good idea of the inner workings of Ducati and how it is, you know, how the technical staff works there, just, you know, the atmosphere, all of those, you know, small intangibles, how much you're listened to, how high-tech everything is and all that stuff that you get from being embedded, all of that info he will get. And it's not going to be the deciding factor, because ultimately the deciding factor is going to be whether the Honda bike gets better. Because if it doesn't, Marc Marquez doesn't need to hear from Alex that he can win on the Ducati. He knows that. We all know that. There's no secret here. We all know that Marc Marquez can win the championship and a bunch of races on the Ducati if he so chooses to go there for 2025. But yeah, it's, you know, I'm sure there will be extra info, and you know, that kind of sort of one indirect foot in the door, that always it helps a little bit. I think it will help Ducati's chances a little bit if Ducati elects to seriously pursue Mark, which we don't know. Maybe not. But if they do, yeah.
I think that is a big, that is something that Ducati are going to take as a bonus. But my gut feeling is that this is a deal that was penned by Gresini because they wanted a guy who can maybe win a race or two a season to replace Enea Bastianini. And Alex Marquez has never really got the chance he deserves to shine in MotoGP because he's always been on a pretty crappy Honda. The guy is a double world champion. If his surname was anything but Marquez, people would be saying, yeah, he deserves this chance. He deserves this chance in his own merit. And I believe I've said it from the start that on his day, he'll go really well on that bike because on their day, it seems at the minute that pretty much every Ducati rider can go well and stick the bike in the podium. And, you know, Gresini are a third tier satellite team with sponsors to appease. And all they want is two or three podium finishes and maybe a win a season to keep the guys that bring the money happy. And Alex Marquez is capable of doing that. So from strictly a team perspective, it's a smart signing for them. But then for the bonus for Ducati is that Marc Marquez gets to see how they operate.
As for the sprint question, I think, you know, Miller's a really good shout. I think many of us expect Ducati to absolutely monster those sprint races and just leave everyone in the dust. I think that's part of it. The only other names that really come to my mind are Marquez, obviously. Yeah, even especially considering the potential fitness question mark, whether it always just remains this way that he doesn't quite have the longevity of his direct rivals. You know, it'll still, Mark can absolutely run 10 laps in front, whatever the bike and whatever the condition. Yeah, Mark's one. I think Alex Rins maybe is the second because we've seen quite a few really good charges from Rins in opening laps. I think Mir is more of a longevity rider at Honda and at Suzuki, and Rins is more of a burst rider. So yeah, those would be my answers. Ducati, Marquez, Rins.
I'd say for those sprint races, Mark Marquez, all bets are off. Aggressive on the first lap, half a distance race, elbows out. Outsucks him on the grid. It's Mark to a T, isn't it?
Similarly, there'll be people who are punished by the sprint race format. People like Brad Binder, people like Enea Bastianini, they're not going to perform as well in sprint races because they're guys that kind of take time to build up ahead of steam and go backwards or go forwards.
They need the second half of the race.
They need the second half of the race, exactly. So it won't be the normal MotoGP finishing order. Both because it'll suit some people's styles and it'll really disadvantage others.
Hope it doesn't lead to some optimistic passing manoeuvres and then visits to the steward's room on a Saturday evening. Okay, right, we've got our last question.
Hi guys, this is Morten from Denmark. Let me start by thanking you for an informative and fun podcast. I listen every week. I have a couple of questions regarding the Moto E series. First of all, I'd like your take on what you think it'll mean for the series that Ducati is taking over from next year. Being the sole supplier of machines, will that change the series? Will it attract other rider profiles? Will it give better or worse racing? What is your take on that? And my second question is, what you see for the future of Moto E? Most manufacturers are working on electric street motorcycles now. Will we see electric motorcycles in MotoGP? Or will it be biofuels only, or even a third possibility? I appreciate your thoughts on that too. Thank you very much, and keep up the good work.
Hey, Martin. Thank you for your question. So let's start with Ducati coming on board. I think there will be, first of all, we're going to see Moto E get faster because we're going from essentially a heavy production bike with technology that's now 5 years old to an absolutely bang up to date prototype machine. You know, it's the first time that Moto E has been a prototype bike. And that in itself is going to make it faster. It's going to be faster. It's going to be more powerful. It's going to be much lighter. We're going to see an advantage there. I say advantage because I don't think it's going to necessarily change the series, because the series is really competitive at the minute. It's really good racing, and it's really entertaining. And that kind of leads into the second bigger impact that I think Ducati are going to make. MotoE has kind of been the stepchild that MotoGP never wanted. They launched the series so that no one else could, the way that Formula E escaped the F1 paddock. And it never got the love it deserved. And I know that in the final stages, the last year and a half or so, that's something that one make manufacturer, Energica, has been quite vocal about, both internally and actually to the media as well. They felt like they've not been given what they deserve. And that's evidenced in the fact that a lot of the sessions aren't even televised. It's really hard to find the races on TV in a lot of countries. It's not been well sold. But now that we're adding the might of the Ducati marketing empire to that, and the fact that Ducati carry an awful lot of weight within the MotoGP paddock because they supply a third of the bikes on the MotoGP grid, we're going to see that dynamic change, and hopefully it pushes what is a great series to a wider audience. Regarding the bigger picture in the longer term, we're never going to see MotoGP... We're not going to see MotoGP go electric in the medium term, at least, I think. Simply because that's not really the way that electric vehicles as a whole are going. Whenever you look at motorbikes, even if it is the way that cars are kind of going with some hybrid technology, electric motorbikes are by and large being developed for city use. They're not being developed for highway use. They're definitely not being developed for circuit use. And I think that we're going to see kind of a split in the way that bikes are manufactured going forwards, and creating like a sort of parallel streams of development where, sure, absolutely things like your Piaggio scooter or your Honda Grom monkey bike will be electric because you're using them for batting around town and they make perfect sense. But no one's going to make an electric BMW GS anytime soon. And while that while that happens, we're still going to see internal combustion MotoGP machines too.
Sustainable fuel is a thing. Sustainable fuel wins in four-wheel sport, at least. It won three stages of the Dakar last year, and it finished second and fourth on the Dakar last year with sustainable fuel. What is sustainable fuel? It is harnessing agricultural waste and the CO2 from that agricultural waste to turn it into a fuel to then burn in an engine, and then the emissions then are reduced by 80% at the exhaust pipe. That could easily be 100% non-fossil fuel usage to move the same vehicle at the same speed over the same distance. Formula One will be on a bio/sustainable fuel in 2026. There's been sustainable fuel running at Le Mans, all sorts of other sustainable fuel running on the Dakar. There was sustainable fuel running with an Aramco blend at the Goodwood Historic Motorsport Revival meeting in the middle of September. So with little adaptation to existing petrol engines, you can run a sustainable fuel. Here and now, arguably, I think that's the solution on a longer term basis.
MotoGP are actually going to step beyond that from 2027, and we're skipping the synthetic or the sustainable fuel step, and we're going directly to 100% synthetic fuel from 2027, which uses renewable electricity generated by wind power to turn seawater into hydrocarbons, which then burn just like petrol. So there are, we're not digging up dinosaurs. We're not creating CO2 until basically you put the fuel into the engine. And I think all these schemes have sort of carbon capture systems built into them. I know that Porsche are developing a massive, like, £150 million plant in, like, southern Chile.
Yeah. Chile, correct. Yeah. It's been running for a couple of years now.
Yeah. And there's also, quite interestingly for MotoGP, there's also a similar project being run in Qatar by the Qatari government. So that will be the MotoGP future for, well, we're not going to go electric whenever the rules are revised for 2027. I can't see us going electric when the rules are revised again 5 years after that. So I think it's safe to say that we're internal combustion until at least 2037.
And just as a slight aside for our listeners, I met up with a guy who is a specialist in electric distribution around the UK, how it's going to get to houses and such like. But one of the things he touched on is that apparently the British government, at least, is going to change and relax the licensing requirements for people to be able, and the age at which they are able to ride an electric scooter mobility device within the confines of a town, to stop them, to get them out of cars, to get them mobile off buses, arguably, because the buses in theory should be full, university campuses and such like, people going to sixth form schools or even under the age of 17, because 17 is the age you can drive a car in the UK, 16 for a moped. But if that is brought down a bit and those rules are relaxed, and apparently in UK government, there's going to be an announcement soon about that. Not sending people 100 miles up the motorway, but more like 3 kilometres around town. So that, in my eyes, is what electric mobility is about. But that's another Pandora's box of discussion that is for another day, and I'm sure many of you tech heads have heard them from other people. In the meantime, thank you for sending in your voice notes. If you do want to ask us a question, send them to podcasts@the-race.com. Get them into us. Keep in touch with the-race.com with our website for all of your Formula One and, more importantly, MotoGP news, because we've got 3 races to go and a MotoGP championship to thrash out. Who will it be? Quartararo, Bagnaia, or even that glimmer of a hope for Espargaro? Let's find out after Phillip Island, when all 3 of us will speak to you then. Goodbye for now.
The Athletic.
Hi everyone, it's Meg Linehan here. If women's soccer is your calling, I'm excited to say my podcast, Full Time, is back on May 23rd. Join myself and my new amazing co-host, Tamara Griffin, every Thursday as we take a deep dive into the biggest stories in the women's game, from the NWSL to the Olympics. We'll bring you in-depth reporting that only The Athletic can provide, chat to leaders within the industry, and chart the next phase of the U.S. Women's National Team as they look to rebuild. Just search for Full Time wherever you get your podcasts and follow and subscribe so you never miss an episode.